reminder to people to put your cell phones, PDAs, on vibrate. You can also turn them off.
But I don't want to
talk. You turned off during the week.
There we go.
It's a pleasure. Welcome, everyone, to the Neil Dublinsky Alav HaShalom Memorial Lecture Series entitled From Individual Adversity to Communal Resilience. This extremely important series, which continues next week at this time with Rabbi Kenneth Brander, is sponsored in memory of two kindred spirits of the Dublinsky-Schwartz families taken from this world tragically early. Neil Dublinsky and Debbie Schwartz Friedman, a blessed memory. Neil Dublinsky was a prince of generosity, courage, and kindness. Graduate of Yeshiva University, where he was the recipient of the Dean Isaac Bacon Award for Excellence in the Humanities, and NYU School of Law, Neil became a prominent securities class action attorney who performed untold acts of charity and kindness. Even more impressive than his resume is his model of transforming adversity into generosity, of transforming a personal battle with cancer into an opportunity to help countless fellow cancer patients. Debbie Schwartz Friedman was raised in the neighborhood, distinguishing herself in scholarship and chesed from a young age. She married Dr. Yoel Friedman of Zurich, Switzerland, settled in Zurich, and raised five beautiful children. With her warm enthusiasm, her zest for life, Debbie enlivened the Zurich community by spearheading chesed committees, teaching creative and thought-provoking Jewish studies classes in its fledgling women's school. Even after she was stricken with her disease, she continued to teach, counsel students, and to undertake and complete chesed projects. May our gathering tonight be a source of aliyah, of spiritual ascent for both Neil and Debbie's souls, and a source of strength for the Dublinsky-Schwartz family. Before I introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. David Pelkovitz, I'd like to thank the two institutional sponsors of the series, Yeshiva University, of which Neil was a graduate, the Eliezer Project, for their very hard work in promoting this series. I'd like to ask Gideon Barry, the executive director of the Eliezer Project, whose important work is very relevant to this lecture series, to give a very brief description of what they do.
Thank you very much, and shidduch to the Dublinsky family for the important work and programming that they're doing. Lezecher Nishmat, these two very remarkable people. The Eliezer Project is our local community organization that responds to people who are in different forms of financial need. Okay, this is not a theoretical thing. This is real. This is the boots on the ground. So I just want to tell you the al regel achat version of what we do. For people who have lost jobs, or for people who are in the process of losing jobs, we help them, and we encourage any of you that know of people in this situation to have them come forward and reach out to us, either through any of the community rabbanim or calling our office directly. We help people rewrite their resumes. We sponsor networking opportunities. We have job boards that we maintain. And we provide chizuk, which is not something that should be underestimated. For many people, it is very comforting to know that they can pick up the phone and talk to someone who, in a non-judgmental way, will encourage them to keep going forward. Because even though job loss in the greater sphere of life is not the most serious tragedy, when you're experiencing it, it's just about the only thing that you can think of. So the Eliezer Project helps people who are in the midst of job loss. The other thing that we focus our energies on are for people who are experiencing financial hardship. Believe it or not, even though the shelves of Gourmet Glot are full and the sushi bars are exploding, there are many people in this community that haven't paid their mortgages in a year, that have credit card debt in excess of $100,000. They simply do not know what to do. When they come to us, we are able to provide them with legal expertise at no cost to them to try to help put their financial lives back in order. Sure, we do all the other little things. We give out candles and oil next to Hanukkah. We give out food at the Yom Tov time. We give out lulavim and esrogim at Sukkot time. But the work that we do that is unique to the Eliezer Project is financial hardship assistance and job search opportunities. I welcome anyone that has a job to offer to let us know about it. I encourage anyone who could possibly use our help, or if you know of anyone that could take advantage of our services, to please step forward. We're there. We want to help. We want to be of assistance. And we thank the community for their continued support. That's where our sustenance comes from. There are some envelopes and pamphlets out front. You're welcome to take it on your way out. And God willing, we should all get to a point where the need for this organization will cease to exist, and we will be able to channel our energies to other worthy causes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Kopinis. Thank you, Rabbi Kopinis.
Now to our keynote speaker. Dr. David Tolkovitz holds the Gwendolyn Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology, Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at YU. He is also Special Assistant to President Richard Joel and teaches pastoral counseling at REITS. Serving for more than two decades as the Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine, and Clinical Professor of Psychology at NYU School of Medicine, Dr. Pelkovitz has consulted extensively with the Jewish community in the United States, Europe, and Israel on a wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. Dr. Pelkovitz has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics related to education, parenting, child mental health. His most recent publication, Balanced Parenting, is a book written in collaboration with his father, Rabbi Raphael Pelkovitz, on parenting from a Jewish perspective. I present to you Dr. David Pelkovitz.
Thank you so much. Let me start. Rabbi Septim is somebody I've known for some time, going back to when he was a pastoral psychology student. I want to share with you, you did great in all the classes. It's just a pleasure to see how wise you all were in bringing him to this community. Before I get into the heart of my remarks, while I didn't know Neil Dublinsky, all of the Shalom, I did know Deborah Schwartz Friedman. I grew up in Far Rockaway. I grew up right in this neighborhood. I had a chance to speak to her after she became ill, and I could see that the cousins shared, I guess, the family bumper sticker, the Dublinsky-Schwartz family bumper sticker, which is Du Chesed, which is to do good. The Schwartzes, when I was growing up, were known as a family of chesed, of living a life that was about giving to others. If the word natan is a palindrome, you give, you get back. I have to think that in my conversations with Deborah, in terms of just sort of her love and concern for the community and for her children, what came through most was how her every fiber of her being was about giving, was about her warmth, and was about everything that she poured into her five children. And I have to believe that the getting back is the sparks of light that she planted in them. If our rabbis tell us, ma'at min ha'or do ha'arbe min ha'choshech, little sparks of light push away a tremendous amount of darkness. When I think about Deborah and I imagine her cousin Neil, what I'm struck by is exactly that. It's exactly the that a life, however short, but lived with love and chesed and giving, has to continue to live on through. through the sparks of light that I know that Deborah and Neil lit for so many people. And may any words of Torah that we review in the next 45 minutes or so be an ilui for their neshama. Okay, let me go to making three points I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus in terms of dealing with loss. I'm going to focus on three areas having to do with resilience. So the focus will be more on what I've learned over the years. My specialty in the secular world has been in working with post-traumatic stress disorder, working with trauma, working with people going through very tough times in their lives. And all the populations I worked with over the years have taught me a tremendous amount. And I just want to share with you a little bit that I learned from people going through these tough times and intersperse with it some of the incredible insights from Torah as well as the insights that maybe integrating it with psychology research gives us. Number one is the concept of perspective. There's a fascinating insight that I heard in the name of Rabbi Schwab, and I guess before that it's been said in the name of Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, that the Hebrew word nechama, which we're used to thinking means comfort, doesn't mean comfort. When you go to be Menachem Aveilon, or if you give nechama to somebody, Rabbi Schwab points out that if you go through the Torah, you'll see that the word nechama has a much deeper meaning than one sees at first glance. He starts with the first time in the Torah that it says the word nechama. Anybody remember the first time? Towards the end of Parshas Bereishis, Hashem is looking down on the world and saying, "Ki nichamti ki asisen," and in a way reconsidering, shifting perspective in terms of making man when the problems and the sins of man become apparent. And then it goes on, Peninachem ha'am b'shavu Mitzrayma. Maybe the people will reconsider and return to Mitzrayim. You go right through Tanakh, you'll see that the word nechama really means shift in perspective. And that doesn't happen right away. A lot of the first part I want to focus on is some of the insights that I've learned from people about that process, that little by little, when people are faced with loss, they're faced with stress, over time, there's a shift in perspective that in turn brings comfort. I'll start with a simple story that I learned in a research project I was doing a number of years ago. I was doing a research project in different parts of the country. We were looking at families of children with cancer. And we were looking at the impact on parents of, God forbid, having a child with cancer. And I was pretty proud of the research protocol that I helped put together, and we had research assistants all over the country implementing the study. And almost immediately, I got angry phone calls from the research assistants telling me, "You have to modify this study, people are complaining like crazy." I had no idea why they were complaining. And they all said the same thing. Everybody is saying, you don't have a single question about what positive happened to us as a result of facing this challenge with our child. So I thought, what chutzpah would that be? How would I dare have the chutzpah to ask parents what positive came from having a child with facing such a serious challenge? But they insisted, because people were really complaining. And of course that became the most valuable part of the study, was when I asked questions about it. And I'll just share with you one answer. And there were many answers like this. It was a basic answer that I think brings into sharper focus this idea of nechama and shift in perspective. And it goes like this. A woman says the following. She says that her son, who was 15, was being treated for acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And one stormy night, her husband is in the hospital sitting by the bedside of her 15-year-old son. And it was an incredible storm. She gets up like 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's time to go to the hospital to spell her husband. And before she could go to her car, her doorbell rings, and it's her next-door neighbor who said that the storm had taken a tree that was between her house and her neighbor's house and blew it into her neighbor's driveway, and it totaled the car. Totaled the car. And the neighbor was like beyond upset. She was saying, what am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? How am I going to get to work? Just totally paralyzed with losing the car. So she took over and she helped her call the insurance adjuster and she offered her a lift to work. And here's what she writes in her response. She said, I drop my neighbor off at work. And as my neighbor's walking into her office, let me tell you what insight flashed into my head. She said, you know something? A year ago, before my son's diagnosis, I would have had the same reaction. Matter of fact, had exactly the same reaction that my neighbor did. But let's say last night the wind was going in the opposite direction. And let's say last night it was my car that was totaled, not my neighbor's car. I would have come out and I would have said, oh, I guess I better call a cab. I wouldn't have even thought about it. I wouldn't have even gotten around to fixing my car probably for weeks. Because I know what's important. I know what matters. What matters is to be by my son's bedside. What matters is to spell my husband so he could get some rest so that he could go to work. A year ago, she writes, my most important thing in my life is perfecting my tennis serve. She said, now I know what matters. That's nechama. That's nechama. It's not necessarily comfort in the way we think about it. It's the nechama that Rav Schwab talks about, the shift in perspective, the reordering of priorities, and the lessons we learn from that kind of shift. It's a complicated process. Nobody can tell us how to shift our priorities. It's an individual lesson that each person comes to. And that gradually brings the important lessons that, as our rabbis tell us, if something terrible happens to you, the second line response after you look at whether or not you need to do some religious adjustments is yifash veish b'masa. You have to do an internal self-examination. Okay, let me make a few more points on this perspective taking. And one is, as often happens, the Parsha has unbelievable insights. The first insight in this week's Parsha is a beautiful, beautiful medrash that it's a fairly well-known medrash, but it's really worth reviewing. And it's such a magnificent lesson on perspective taking in the face of tragedy, in the face of loss, and in terms of resilience. And it's on the pasuk in this week's parsha of Ayered Yehuda Mi'Esecha. And here's what the Medrash tells us. So Yehuda goes, and it's his going to get involved with Tamar in the whole story of Yehuda and Tamar that we all know about. And the Medrash beautifully describes what seems to the naked eye to be the low point in Jewish history. Think about this. Think about what was happening at that point in Jewish history. It says Yaakov was sitting b'sako v'tanisa. Yaakov was sitting down in his sackcloth and fasting because he's in mourning for his son. What happened to Yosef? The brothers, same thing. They're filled with guilt. They're beyond tears. They're also, the Medrash tells us, sitting down in sackcloth with remorse and just emotionally devastated with the horrendous, horrendous act that they committed. Where was Yosef? Yosef is sitting in prison at this time. Okay, at this time, Yosef, the Medrash tells us, is also sitting literally in prison, also in sackcloth and fasting. And then, listen to the way the Medrash ends. B'HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is looking down on the scene that to the naked eye looks like basically the end of the Jewish people. And what does God see? Oro Shel Mashiach. Why does God see that? God sees the light, the glimmering of the light of ultimate redemption. Because what's happening? God has the perspective to look at what's happening with Yehuda and Tamar. And what's happening with Yehuda and Tamar? What's happening with Yehuda and Tamar is now carrying the baby who eventually becomes the line of the Davidic dynasty, of Mashiach. It's an amazing, amazing lesson. Is that sometimes we look at things from our very strange kind of perspective because we have such a limited perspective. And I hear this all the time from people I work with. It's not that anybody welcomes tragedy, God forbid. And it's not in any way to minimize the legitimacy of sadness or difficulty or of people's right to mourn and feel strongly, God forbid. But it's the idea that what we always come to eventually in that Nechama process is ultimately some kind of shift in perspective that brings comfort. So that's that piece in the Parsha. Let me give you a study and maybe one more point before I move to the two next points on perspective taking. It's a study slash story. Listen to this. I have a colleague at UCLA, head of child psychiatry at UCLA, Bob Pinus, major expert in traumatic events and loss and a challenge. He tells me the following story. He did a study in 1991. In 1991 in Los Angeles, there was a school shooting. And a bunch of little kids, elementary school age kids, were pinned down by the fire and some were unfortunately killed. And there were 2 9-year-old boys who were right next to each other. They weren't injured, but they had exactly the same level of exposure. They were exactly equidistant from the shooter. One was a mess, severe post-traumatic stress reaction. The other was 100% fine. So Dr. Pinus was trying to figure out, look, if I could bottle what's behind the resilience of this child who's fine, it would be pretty nice. So he sits down with the boy to interview him, and he says, why are you doing so well? It's amazing. Look what you went through. Why are you doing so well? And the kid says, oh, the shooting. He says, let me tell you about the shooting. He said, the week before the shooting, I went to an earthquake preparation course in my community. They said, if there's ever an earthquake, here's exactly what to do. You go for cover, you crouch down, you dive for cover. So I hear the shooting, and I tell myself, well, this is a little bit like an earthquake. And I do exactly what they told me to do. So I knew I'd be fine. Now, in reality, the kid was no safer than the kid next to him, but he believed he was. The Baal Shem Tov tells us, "B'makom shemachshavto shel adam shamhu nimtza ha'ish." If you want to know where the real person is, look at where his or her thoughts are. Get into their head. And that's exactly what was happening here. What was happening here is this kid had the adults around him give him a sense of preparation, a sense of knowing what to do, which ultimately for him became an nechama. It gave him a sense of active control, and that made all the difference in terms of giving him, I guess, the bitachon or the emunah or whatever you want to say to be able to get through it in a relatively resilient manner. Again, that's perspective. Perspective is massaging. So if you take it and put it together, what we see is, let's put it together, the lessons of the 3 or 4 things that we talked about. So the commonality of the tree and understanding what really matters in life. It's not things, it's people. The commonality of the story and the Medrash of Oro Shel Mashiach, of being able to look at the big picture. And the commonality of what Rav Schwab tells us, and the child in the earthquake, is basically that to the extent that we could develop that long-term view in terms of perspective taking, that's ultimately where the Chama comes from. But how to do it is very complicated. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. So that's part one. And let me just end it with a couple of guidelines from psychology on perspective taking. And one of them is, again, beautifully described in this week's Parsha, where on the first pasuk, if you look at Rashi, it says that Rashi quotes the Medrash Rabbah, who says, "Bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalva." Yaakov looked to live a life of tranquility. He'd been through a lot. He finally looks to settle down and have a life of tranquility without challenge. And the Medrash is critical of Yaakov for wanting that. So Yerucham Lubavitz, one of my favorite psychologists, says the following. So this is in pre-Holocaust Europe. Yerucham Lubavitz asks the obvious question. Who could blame Yaakov for wanting to live in peace? Who among us doesn't want to live in peace? He said, it's to teach us that that should not be the goal of a Jew. The goal of a Jew should be to take whatever stress comes your way and convert it from threat to challenge. To take the nisayon, the challenge of any trials and tribulations that comes our way, and to turn it into a growth-inducing opportunity. Interestingly, psychologically, every study I've been able to see on dealing with some of the tough times in life is when we're able to transform it from threat to challenge, we do much better. So that ends perspective taking. Now, please, don't take this the wrong way. I'm not, God forbid, saying, I'll say it again, I'm not, God forbid, saying that people don't have the right to feel any way they feel. This is more of a very long-term approach in terms of how I understand what people teach me. When I spend the Shabbos at a High Lifeline retreat, or go to some other retreats, which I'll tell you about, where I'm working with families who are going through incredibly tough times in life, the overwhelming lesson I get is about how people grow and live deeper lives when they're able to transform the threat to challenge and have that Oros Shel Mashiach perspective. Okay, that's part one. Let's go to part two. Part two is, and this is one of the main points I want to make, and it's going to have a couple of stories. I'm going to make this point mainly through some stories. It has to do with coping. And it has to do with what research study after research study shows, that there isn't one coping style that works. Men and women often have totally different coping styles in dealing with the challenges of life. Coping is something that comes in many different sizes. And this lesson that I want to give over is contained a few times in Shas, that on the Pasuk in Proverbs in Mishlei, where it says, Dabar b'lev ish yashchena, if you have a worry in your heart, talk it out. So there's machlokas between Rabbami and Ravasi, Chara miyashchena midato, Chara miyasichena lachera. One says, if you have a worry in your heart, put it down, distract yourself. The other says, if you have a worry in your heart, talk it out. And it's interesting. The Gemara doesn't tell us that one way is right, one way is wrong. That's exactly what modern research is showing. It depends what works for your coping style. I'm going to give you a double story, and then we'll give some take-home messages on this coping thing. The double story goes like this. In 2002, I believe it was, I was in Israel. I was asked to give a series of talks to some trauma specialists there. They know much more about trauma than I ever will, unfortunately. They couldn't think straight for themselves. There's a saying, the Gemara has, Ein chavish matar atzmo mibeis hasher. You can't free yourself from your own prison. So I was asked to give a talk to about 40 therapists in the Jerusalem Trauma Center. It was the height of the Intifada. And it was a terrible time. There were bombings every day. And as I'm giving the talk there, Dr. Brahm, the head of the center, gets a phone call that there was a bombing in the Frank Sinatra cafeteria at the Hebrew University on Herzlfim, and 9 people were killed. 7 of them happened to have been Americans. It was the largest toll of death of Americans during the Intifada, the Second Intifada. Immediately, the phone rings off the hook, and people are called all over, from all over Israel. They're calling, we need help, we need help. In terms of psychological support. Israel is such an interconnected society. One person's in pain, everybody's in pain. Of course, the whole audience clears out. And Dr. Brahm comes over to me and he says, I just got a call from a camp in the middle of the country, a summer camp, where their head madricha was killed in the bombing. Can you go? We're short staffed. We don't have anybody left. Do you mind going? And he sent an Israeli colleague with me. And we get in the car and we go to the middle of Israel to go to a camp where there's a whole group of kids who now had to be told that their beloved head madrikha had been killed, the head counselor. And we were asked to spend the day with them, just to help them deal with the enormity of what just happened. In Israel, they don't let psychologists take over. They don't let anybody take over. They know what they're doing, and they certainly don't like taking orders from any American. So they immediately put me in my place. They put me in a corner of the room with my colleague. And the director of the camp gets up, and he tells the kids this horrific piece of news. And here's where the incredible wisdom of this man, and I think of Israelis in general, in dealing with the experiences of loss and trauma came in. He tells the kids, there are five coping rooms. One room is a room where I want you to sit down and write letters to the parents of the madrikha about what a wonderful woman she was. Daga b'levish, in a sense, yasichen alachem. Write about her. Next room is an art room. Express yourselves artistically. Next room is a music room. Express yourselves musically. The next room is a davening room. And then the fifth and final room is a talking room where they could sit down with me and my colleague. Right? So it's writing, art, music, davening, and talking. And the kids were told you could go from room to room throughout the day. Just go from room to room. And it was fascinating what I learned that day. Because none of the kids switched. They divided themselves exactly equally among four of the five rooms. Anybody want to guess what room they didn't pick? Huh? Interesting. I'm sorry?
The davening.
Very good. Very few. Is that what you said also, davening? You said talking, right? Almost everybody says talking. But you got it. They didn't pick davening. Any guesses why? Why did they pick davening? There could be interesting guesses. It could be that adolescence is a local. Yeah, yeah.
They were non-rooms.
So there's nothing except that you could say that it was in memory, in her memory, possibly. There are a lot of things. But look, part of it may be that adolescence is not a time that kids connect easily. Another possibility is that they were all collectively in a state of aninos. It was too soon for tefillah, like you say. She was gone already. There was nothing to daven for in that sense. It was too soon to connect to the next level. The funeral hadn't taken place yet.
Also, maybe because it's more abstract for them?
Maybe, right. At that age, it's harder to connect to. But what was amazing to me, what I learned from that day, was the art kids expressed themselves artistically. The music kids did music all day. And the talking kids talked. We had an unbelievable day of talking, etc. I learned an amazing lesson about the multiplicity of coping, and I go back to America the next week, and it was 9/11. The first anniversary of 9/11. And I was asked to give a talk at a commemoration. And I told over this story, because I had learned so much from this story. And a woman shares the following with our group. She says that her father was the Vizhnitsa Chassid, who was in the concentration camps with Elie Wiesel. The famous picture of Elie Wiesel peeking out of his bunk with, I think, two or three of his other kids. Actually, I know one of them was a very close friend's father, who I grew up with in Far Rockaway. And she says one of them was her father, the Chassid. And the week before, she had gone to a lecture given by Professor Wiesel, given by Elie Wiesel. And her father, who's still alive, said, give him regards for me. Maybe he'll remember. She says, I don't know if he'll remember me. He's had a very busy life since then. But give him regards. So she waits online after the talk. And she goes over to Elie Wiesel. And she says, you know, my father, you know, I don't know if you remember him. You were together in the camps. Do you remember him? And Mr. Wiesel, immediately tears come to his eyes. He says, he didn't tell you? She says, well, what? He didn't tell you that he saved my life? That the only reason I'm here, the only reason I've accomplished whatever I accomplished is because of your father? She says, no, he never said a word to me. He says, go home and remind your father of this story. He said, there was a horrible day, even by concentration camp standards. A horrible day. They were being tortured and beaten and starved beyond endurance. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison. And they decided to take the rat poison. Who could blame them? And they go online, and they patiently wait online to take the rat poison. One by one, they took the poison. One by one, they go to lay down to die. Adolescence is a time that suicidality is at its height. It's very contagious at that age. So all the teens of that block in the camp joined the Germans, including Elie Wiesel, joined the Russians to take their life. And he said, we were fully intending to end our life that day. He said, everybody but your father. He says, your father remained the chassid even there. And he goes off to the side of the line, and he breaks out into this ancient Vishnus Enigin, I believe in ultimate redemption. And the song broke our suicidal spell. One by one we left the line. One by one we surrounded your father and joined him in singing Vani Manan. He says, go home, remind your father, everything I've accomplished is because of him. Okay? Powerful. Coping comes in many different flavors. Sometimes it's music, sometimes it's art. Sometimes it's writing, sometimes it's davening, and it varies from person to person, as Rav Aminu Ravasi tells us. And we have to respect other people's right to find their own way. When we do therapy, some of the treatments we develop for abused children, one of the things we do, based on this lesson that I learned from that woman and from the kids in Israel during the Intifada, is we'll show kids who have been abused upsetting film clips, like 10-minute film clips for movies. And then we'll ask them to rate how upset they are. Then we have a table filled with upset with coping mechanisms. So we'll have perfumes and sports magazines and comic books and art materials and iPods. And we have them go, and they usually gather four or five of the ways of soothing themselves in the groups that we do, and they soothe themselves. And we find that each kid has a different toolbox of coping mechanisms, and over time we build with them their own toolbox of coping mechanisms. How would you try this at home? You try it at home with whatever. Life's about stress. Again, to reframe what Rav Yerucham said about this week's Parsha. It's what Maseilas Yesharim says. The purpose of life is lamo b'nisyonos. It's to withstand some of the trials and tribulations. That's when you're living life to the fullest. And the answer in part is, how do you find the ways and the tools of coping that work best for you? Rav Hirsch brilliantly, brilliantly said that the valuation of keli keli lama azavtani is wrong. It's not, he says, Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani, God, why have you forsaken me? It's Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani. For what purpose have you abandoned me? Right? You know, you change the why to the what, as many of our rabbis have taught us. And when you change the why to the what, things change tremendously. Things change tremendously. Okay, so that's the second main point I want to make, is the point of coping. And a related story and point 2B, before I go to my final point, to bring it to an end by 9 o'clock, goes like this. Genders differ often in coping. So I'm talking about couples. Dr. John Mordechai Gottman, who does all this incredible research on marriages and on couples, very respected research. He happens to wear a big yarmulke on his head. He's a very interesting person, a respected person from Seattle, rated by many surveys as the leading marital therapy researcher in the United States. So one of the things he does, he's the guy, you might have read about him in Blink, he hooks couples up and he has them fight. He hooks them up to biofeedback equipment. And he's the guy who in 7 minutes could tell with 94% accuracy that they'll be divorced in 5 years. Okay? And then he fixes it. He doesn't then give you the card of a divorce lawyer. He fixes it. But one of the things that his research shows is that when men discuss their problems with their wives, and women discuss their problems with their husbands, there's a totally different response. The average woman, the more she talks about what she's upset about with her husband, the more her blood pressure goes down, the more her pulse rate goes down, the calmer she gets. Words and discussion chill out 80% of women. Not all women, but 80%. The average man, the opposite happens. The more he talks about what he's upset about, 80% of men, the more his blood pressure goes up, the more his pulse rate goes up, the more sick he feels. See, the average man feels sick for a couple hours after having a difficult discussion. So the very thing that's the source of refuah for the average woman is the source of machal, of illness, for the average man. Many of us could relate to this. So what do you do about that? What do you do about the fact that what happens if you're married to somebody with a diametrically opposed set of coping mechanisms to you? So I'm going to illustrate what I think is the partial response with the story, and then I'll bring this to a close with the third and final main point. First High Lifeline Retreat. It's about, I think, close to 20 years ago. And I've been privileged to volunteer to be the psychologist in residence for these retreats since they started. A new one is going to be in just a couple of weeks. So it's the first High Lifeline Retreat. It's where I saw your daughter, okay, at one of them. I was so impressed with her. I hadn't seen her since she was little. Yeah, it's a show this weekend. She's such an impressive woman. That's why I'm so privileged to be able to talk about her. So here's the first High Lifeline Retreat. First High Lifeline Retreat. Everybody's nervous. Nobody knows if it's going to work. It was a strange setup of people. High Lifeline brings the whole range, the whole gamut of people, ranging from Sabra Hasidim to intermarried couples. An idea of putting them together for a Shabbos, who knew? All they have in common is a kid with cancer. That's all they have in common. So I'm getting up to speak at the very first mental health talk at that weekend. And before I could open my mouth, a couple comes marching down the center aisle, and the husband starts screaming at me. And he says, you know, you have my body here, my mind's going to be a million miles away, I'm not going to listen to a word you have to say. And he rushes back to his seat. So I run after him. I say, what's the deal? And I'm thinking, I could be home with my family. Who needs this, you know? And he says, look, he says, I'm a physician, he tells me. He's a physician. He says, my son was diagnosed with cancer. And I've spent the last year going around the world to find the best treatment protocol for him. That's the way I cope. I'm a problem solver. And I finally get a weekend away. There are counselors to watch my kids. There's a beautiful resort hotel here that I'm spending Shabbos in. And I just want to relax for the first time in a year. I could do it now. There are wonderful oncologists to watch my kid. Everything is taken care of. And she, he points to his wife, is making me come listen to you. And she's in the background mouthing off to me, make him stay, make him stay. So I tell him, I say, look, I said, please go to your room, it's fine. And he doesn't wait to hear. So listen, he runs back to his room. I don't see him for the rest of the weekend. That's it. I don't see him at all. And she spends the entire weekend sitting in the last row, last seat, shooting these dirty looks at me. So that's it. 6 years go by, and there's a priority one Shabbaton 6 years later. So you know, for families of kids who are at risk, who become sort of like off the derech. Again, I'm standing up behind the shtender Friday night, 6 years later, and the same couple comes marching down the center aisle, and the guy sees I have post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm ducking behind the shtender, like, to try to get away. And he sees that I'm nervous, and he says, don't worry, I have a great story for you. Here's what he tells me. He says, that weekend 6 years ago was a turning point in our marriage. I learned that my wife needs to listen to people like you. She needs to express herself. She needs to talk in groups. That's her style. She learned that I need to go into my cave, that I'm a problem solver. And over the last 6 years, what happened was, the more I accepted her style, the more she accepted my style, the more together we became. She says, my son with cancer, he tells me, is fine. Thank God he's cancer-free. Doctors say he's going to be fine. From everything they could tell, he's licked it. He said, but now my oldest daughter figures it's her turn, and she's become quite a rebellious kid. But he says, I got news for you. I'm going to be at every session this Shabbos. He said, every session. And he was. He said, because as I met with acceptance of my style, and she met with acceptance of her style, we've met in the middle. And I think it's a very interesting, Mr. Hostel, that sometimes change comes better from acceptance than from conflict. Okay, exactly how to implement it, I don't know, but okay. So that ends part two. That ends coping. And let me end with the most obvious part, which is connection. Okay, so we did perspective, we did coping, we did connection. With this, I'll bring it to a close. And it goes like this. It's that great, great study. Listen to this study. It happened a couple of years ago. I've been saying it over and over again since I came across the study. It goes like this. You take a person alone and bring them to the bottom of the hill. And you ask them to estimate the steepness of the hill. Okay? The average person will see the hill of their alone is pretty steep. You bring somebody to their side, and together they're asked to estimate the steepness of the hill looks less steep. And the closer you are to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks and the less tired you get walking up the hill. Isn't that beautiful? That idea of connection, of togetherness, as the ultimate antidote. Because connection brings the nechama. It's through the connection that the magic of that ma'amin and ha'ar, gohar habe menachosha, takes place. I have a colleague who I've done some writing with, a well-known psychiatrist who's an expert in trauma, Bessel van der Kolk. He used to be at Harvard, now he's a professor of psychiatry at Boston University Medical School. And he showed me an unbelievable fMRI. It's a picture of a brain of a man stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center on 9/11 who barely escapes with his life. And he shows me, what does the brain of a person look like as they're reliving the worst moment of their life? As he's flashing back to that horrible day in September 2001. And what you see when you look at that picture of the man's brain at that horrible moment is Broca's area shut down. The language centers of the brain are shut down. And the refuah, the cure, he shows in subsequent fMRIs, comes as you give him words for his pain, as he lights up Broca's area, as he talks it out, that's where the healing comes from. That's where the healing comes from. It's a fascinating, fascinating description of what happens through that connection and what happens as we face the trials and tribulations and the sionos of life together and walk up the hill together. And I think I'm going to end, I could go on and on, as you probably see, but I'm going to end to be a man of my word with a story I haven't told over very often. But I have a Bartaranist story running through my head. I think I'm going to end with the story. And it's a relatively recent story. And it's a little bit about, I hope it's okay, but it's a little bit about the nechama process, the growth that I see, where I learn the most when I spend time with people, the lessons, the vicarious lessons that I learn from people who are at the bottom of the hill facing some of the most difficult challenges of life. And this came from a weekend I was at last year. And it was a different kind of weekend. It was a weekend mostly of Satmar Hasidim, where it was a Shabbos we spent. It's Satmar Hasidim who have kids with special needs. So they're kids with all kinds, like pretty severely disabled children. I very much was nervous about going. I schlepped my poor wife with me, who's a good sport about all of this. We couldn't imagine what it was going to be like, and here I was, the court guy there, you know, beardless, and what's that?
Paceless.
Yeah, paceless, beardless, but they were very nice to me. Even when I left early after Shabbos, to them it was probably still very much Shabbos, but I had a lot to give a talk in Queens. They were wonderful to me. It was a terrific, terrific Shabbos. And of course, those Shabbosim are when I grow and learn the most. And I'm going to end with just a vignette that I learned a tremendous amount from. Spending Shabbos meeting with these families, talking to them, and just learning a tremendous, tremendous amount from them. And see, this guy comes over to me. He says, you know, he says, I have a 7-year-old or 8-year-old son who was born severely, severely impaired. And the doctors tell me that, you know, he's going to be severely retarded, mentally retarded, and cognitively impaired, but also he'll never sit up. He'll never be able to sit up. And they say, look, and part of the problem is if you don't sit up, you can't connect to other people, it's just going to be an incredibly limited life. And I heard about some physical therapy researchers in Europe who do therapy with kids with this kind of condition where they could eventually, they had some success with teaching them to sit up. So I go to Europe, and we get him the therapy, and he starts to make a little bit of progress, but I couldn't afford it. I couldn't afford to stay there. I couldn't afford the trips. And they connected to me, and they decided that they're going to teach me how to do the therapy myself. So I spent a number of months there, and I learned how to do the therapy myself to the extent that I could as a layman. And I worked for years on my son. And now he and his wife are looking at me with excitement. They say, do you mind if we show you him? If we have him come to see you. And he calls over the counselor. And the counselor wheels this child over in a wheelchair. And the child's sitting up. And the child, who's clearly severely impaired, flashes me and his parents a $1 million smile. A $1 million smile. Filled with energy, filled with spark. And we all three of us, start crying tears of joy. And I was thinking about it. What's this joy about? What's this simcha about? The severely impaired kid who can engage in the simplest of acts of zokeif kafufim, of being able to sit up? Do we ever, for 1 second, even if we say brachas with kavanah every morning, think to say the bracha that way? Of course not. But they squeezed more meaning out of the simple act of sitting up than many, many people do in a lifetime. And that was their nechama. And that's the message, I think, that I want to leave you all with, L'zecher Nishmas, these two remarkable people. And it's the message, again, of Ma'at Min Ha'or, Docha Harbei Min Ha'choshech. The ingredients are the combination of the perspective and the connection and the being together at the bottom of the hill, and coming up with that multiplicity of coping, and may we all be zoche to continue to take inspiration from the lessons taught to us by people who I think whose lives, from everything I've heard about Neil and what I saw personally with Deborah, and to be able to bring that insight into our daily lives with those sparks of light. So thank you, everybody, and it's 1 o'clock.